Welcome to the Ephesiology Podcast and our series, Archaeology Meets Missiology, the mission of God in the records of time. As always, we are joined by Michigan Cooper, our resident ephesiologist, and I'm Andrew Johnson in Victoria, BC. And at this point, I don't know if we can actually call them bonus episodes, because this is going to be essentially a continuation of the podcast series as we are engaging with Dr. Michael Cooper. His new book, it's four different things, Michael. Gods, Emperors, Philosophers, and a New Movement.
That sounds like a good title.
Okay, so I did actually get it from memory. Y'all, I don't want kudos or awards, but this is the first time I think I've actually said it properly or close. I'll say close the whole time since your book has come out. And so we are going into some of the things that you, Michael, wrote about and specific ideas and questions that are birthed out of what history has actually shown us. And so today we wanted to chat a little bit about Philadelphia. So Michael, why are we going to Pennsylvania? What is this thing about the city of brotherly love that we want to discuss on our podcast on archaeology and missiology?
Yeah, only several thousand miles away from the Philadelphia that we're familiar with here. The Philadelphia that is in Asia Minor and one of the seven churches that Jesus writes a letter to in the book of Revelation. And it's an interesting city for many, many reasons, and we'll get into some of that today. But it was known as the city of brotherly love. It derives that name from the dynasty that was in power just before the turn of the millennium that we call the Attalid dynasty. And the brothers in the Attalid dynasty were known for having brotherly love, and there were some political things going on at the time, one of the brothers kind of deferred to the other brother, and so the city became known as the city of brotherly love just because of their relationship. So,
okay.
So yeah, it's an interesting place.
Okay, so Philadelphia finally, it gets its title because of two actual brothers who were ruling.
Yep.
Because of how they treated each other, because of how they ruled. What about the Attalid dynasty? Aside from the name, what about that dynasty took root in that Philadelphian culture? What about the area is emblematic of that time?
Yeah, well, Philadelphia becomes known as a gateway city. And that title, I think, is probably originally given to it by William Ramsay, who was one of the early researchers of that area, but it acts as kind of a gateway from Phrygia to the rest of the world. And of course, that being the location of the Attalid dynasty, it shares a lot of characteristics in terms of the things or the gods and goddesses that were worshipped there. Many other things like that. Interestingly enough, the city itself becomes known as the Little Athens. And while today, if you go and visit it, you'd wonder why it was known that by that moniker, because there's hardly anything that's been excavated there. Mm. Because there's a modern city that is built on top of the ancient city. And yet the descriptions, it's terribly inconvenient because the ancient descriptions of the city are really remarkable. I mean, it's, we know that there were many temples there to Dionysus and Artemis and Zeus and others. I think there were as many as seven temples that were in that city, but none of them have been excavated. So they're all still under housing or dirt or whatever. They've only just recently, in the past few years, begun to excavate the theater that's there. And even when you visit it, I've visited it a couple times and have been able to go down and look around. There's just not a whole lot to see at this point. But so it was among the chapters that I had to write for this book dealing with the seven churches. This was perhaps one of the most challenging just because of the lack of information that we have, archaeological information that we have.
Okay, so with the limited archaeological information that is available to us, in combination with what we have, the words of Jesus, does the limited archaeological evidence point in the direction of Jesus' letter, right? So in Jesus' letter to Philadelphia, Revelation chapter 3, it is complementary. There's commendation from Jesus to this church. So does the archaeological record say, and it was wonderful bananas after that? It was just great. This church grew. It was this pillar for the church in all of Asia, right? Is that what the archaeological record points to?
Yeah. You know, sadly, it doesn't. Not that it won't at some point. Hopefully it will if further excavation is permitted. But you're right. I mean, Jesus writes a letter of commendation to this church. It's a faithful church. It's only one of two that do not have a rebuke. And Jesus seems to have to be quite sympathetic with this church. He recognizes it as having little power, and yet it's remained faithful. He talks about, you know, Philadelphia being given an open door, and that's been interpreted various ways. Partly, you know, as an open door to the rest of Asia Minor, perhaps for missionary efforts. And we do know from the region that there are missionaries sent to different parts of Asia Minor. But it certainly is a strategically located city, and was important in terms of travel and communication there.
So how, I mean, I guess that's again, this is all things that point to the limited information that we have. Does the historical record that we have point to something that commendation was earned for a while, or does it point to something maybe that soon after, or very soon after, kind of took a hard right or a hard left or just a very different direction?
Well, it does do that. I mean, the letter itself does that. The letter that Jesus writes does that. And again, unfortunately, the archaeological record isn't a lot of help here. And so we have to rely much more on the literary record. You know, we rely upon what is called the numismatic record as well, the record of coins.
Okay.
You know, so coins have been found in various places that have depictions of temples and gods and goddesses and so on. And so that gives us a picture, really, that this place was quite religious. It would have had all sorts of different people who were practicing anything from, you know, the worship of Dionysus to Kybele and all of the things associated with those, the practices of speaking in ecstatic languages and drunkenness. Philadelphia itself, and still today, is located in a very fertile part of Turkey, and it became known for its vineyards, and so hence the connection with Dionysus. And so we look at the geography of the area, the numismatic record, and it does paint us a nice portrait of the things that are going on there. Along with the literary record, we can have a fairly clear understanding of the social pressures that the church was facing, both on a religious level as well as on an imperial level.
So from the literary record, I don't know. I like saying coin record, right? Numismatic just doesn't really like capture what it is. Side note, I wonder what people will look at looking back at our currency today and what they will extrapolate about the nations of today based on the numismatic record. I'm thinking about coins that I grew up with, and I'm like, yeah, that's not us. But anyway, another podcast for another day. So the literary record has given us an understanding of the pressures that the church faced, the imperial pressures, political pressures are imperial pressures, the religious pressures. What were the things that the church in Philadelphia was really up against? And then what kind of shaped its direction moving forward?
Yeah, well, in Jesus's letter to the church, he makes mention of a synagogue of Satan, that there are Jews there who aren't really Jews. And it kind of paints a broad picture that the religious environment, as much as there was the worship of various gods and goddesses, there were also a population from of Jews. And Jews probably isn't the right word here. It would be a combination of those who came to the area or resided in the area after one of the captivities that we read about in the Old Testament. Or they were actual converts to Judaism, and so there's a mixture of those. But Jesus makes reference in chapter 3, verse 9, that I will make those of the synagogue of Satan who say that they are Jews and are not, but lie, behold, I will make them come and bow down before your feet. And so you have this interesting picture. And I talk about this in some detail in the book about how the Judaism of the first century in Asia Minor, as well as in other parts of the Roman Empire, was really an accommodating Judaism, and where they began, because of social pressures, political pressures, mm-hmm. and so on, they began to at least at minimum acknowledge the presence of other deities while they worshiped Yahweh. But in some cases, they would participate in various food rituals to these different gods and goddesses. And I think Paul paints a picture of this in 1 Corinthians, for example, in the context of Corinth, where Jews were participating in eating food sacrificed to idols. And then even in Luke's account of the early history of the church in Acts 19, when there's a near riot in Ephesus over Artemis, that there were also apparently Jews present participating in the theater activities that Luke records. And so we have this kind of interesting picture of religious syncretism in Philadelphia, as much on the part of those who were practicing Judaism as on the part of you know, the practice of other religions that were going on there as well.
So the Christianity, the church, that Jesus has, he has established his church. They are growing. They are faithful. They are standing apart from the syncretism that is coming. And again, all of this is like encouraging, you know, stand against the synagogue of Satan. You are this pillar, the one that will be rooted and standing. But the literary record points to something else that came about.
Yeah. Yeah. So
from about, this church,
from the area.
Okay.
The connection with the church is hard to determine, but certainly with the area. So again, setting the context of the worship of Dionysus and Artemis and Cybele, kind of being the context from where people convert to Christianity, it's almost inevitable that some of those who switch their religion from, you know, the worship of these gods and goddesses to Christianity will also bring with them some of their former religious practices. And again, this doesn't surprise us. That's what 1 Corinthians is really about, in large measure, especially beginning in chapter 8 through to chapter 14. Paul's trying to correct those kind of religious practices that new Christians brought with them from their old ways into the context of the church. And so in the region of Philadelphia, about 100 years or so after the Apostle Paul, so the middle second century, we have the rise of what becomes known as the new prophecy. I refer to it in the book as a new religious movement, and it really was. In many ways, it was distinct from Christianity in terms of its practices. It still held on to, it seems, to a faithful Christology, and yet some of the activities that grew into that church seem to be clearly practices that were brought in from the worship of other gods and goddesses.
We're talking about the syncretism of the Jews in the area being accommodating, worshiping Yahweh and also some other local gods as well, just for good measure. That seems foolish, right? And we say, oh, that's not good. But you're saying the church in the area, so right, whether it's the actual church of Philadelphia, but the church in the area also seemed to take on some new practices based on the new prophecy. What were some of the components of new prophecy? What were some of the things that this thing that was, it wasn't Christian, but it was pseudo Christian. What were some of the things that they believed?
And this is where it gets a little difficult to determine, you know, was this a Christian movement? Was it aberrant in some way? And there are aspects of it that certainly deviated from what becomes known as Orthodox Christianity, but there are other aspects of it that seem to be genuinely Orthodox. But whatever this movement was, we know something about it because of the people who led it. And it later becomes known as Montanism. And Montanism takes its name from its founder, Montanus, who has been described in various ways as having been a priest of Cybele and Dionysus, which seems to have influenced some of the activities that go on in this movement. And the movement really was focused on this idea of it bringing a new prophetic voice to Christianity. In fact, it would go as far as to say that this voice now that they're speaking prophetically from the Lord supersedes what was previously spoken. And so this is the authority for the church. Hmm. And that,
that
seems
is problematic.
Where that seems a little problematic. Yeah. But as much as we can celebrate, you know, the idea of the importance of the prophetic ministry, which I think in part Montanism does, it does at some level restore that ministry and its importance. We also have to be aware that it can be distorted. And in this case, I think, as near as I can tell, this is an example where a new Christian Montanus who comes from, you know, he comes from leadership in a pagan worship of Cybele and Dionysus, where he brings his zeal for religion and some of his former practices into a new faith, and brings them together and syncretizes the two to where, you know, now he is prophesying. He continues to prophesy much like he did in his worship practices of Dionysus and Cybele. And that has an impact. Of course, it's in Christian language now, mm-hmm. but it has an impact on it has an impact on Christianity for probably 200-300 years at least. By some accounts, it might have influenced Christianity for as many as 500 or 600 years, And the influence is quite geographically spread, which is super fascinating.
Okay, so to reword what you just said, Montanism came in with a new word from the Lord, something that was, you know, John referred this. You say this in your chapter, you know, John said that the Paraclete is coming. The Paraclete, you know, the Holy Spirit is going to be with you. And Montanus comes in and says, the Paraclete has spoken, and this revelation that I have, this new word, it's new and improved. It's better than anything that we have heard before, and so much better that we need to disregard what we have heard before, because what I am bringing is this new way. And so we need to trust this new word. I don't know if we have time today to kind of talk about what is this new word, but what was Montanus's direction? What was, if you could boil it down to like a sentence or two, what was the direction he was trying to point people to? Or what was the direction he was taking the church?
Yeah, well, I think, and that's where the church in Philadelphia comes in, and particularly the letter to the church where Jesus talks about the New Jerusalem. So Montanus believed that the New Jerusalem would be somewhere in the region of Philadelphia. And so his prophetic ministry, if you will, his prophetic pronouncements would have these kind of apocalyptic urgency to them, that these things are going to happen, and if you're going to be on the right side of the Lord, then that is going to require certain rigorous moral demands. And so, for instance, you know, they would completely reject second marriages. They would no longer accept those who had strayed from the faith, or you know, those who would eventually be called the lapsed, those who rejected because of persecution or some pressures the faith that they had had at once. And so they were much more rigorous in the moral requirements of Christians. But not only that, and there's something positive, of course, to say about this.
Please, you know, tell me the positives, because right now I'm not seeing a whole lot of positives.
Well, we want to be morally rigorous, don't we, in our faith? We don't want to be willy-nilly and you know, getting involved in all sorts of things. And but it comes with with measure too. And the measuring rod for Montanus was the prophecy that he was giving. You know, in some of his prophecies, he would declare that he is the spokesperson of God. And so that is a problem. Yes.
Yeah. It almost sounds like Harold Camping's dad, right?
Oh, like, yeah.
Like
yeah.
All the things that we have heard about these, I know when God is coming back and he's coming back on this date. So because I am his messenger, you need to do what I say, sell the stuff, come to this location, inhabit these new ways of living.
Yeah.
Because he is coming back at this time in this place, right. And I am his spokesperson.
Yeah, well, there was in Montanus, there was definitely a preference for where he was geographically located, that this was a special place, and attention needed to be given to that place. That being said, his influence was widely felt in the church, and we know that some of his beliefs, we don't know exactly what of his beliefs were spread, but some of his beliefs were influential in the ancient city of Lyon and Vienna in modern-day France, where Irenaeus eventually ends up being the bishop. He deals with Montanism there, but on a positive way, in a positive light. Because one of the hallmarks of Montanism was the restoration of ministry for all people. And in that sense, it was viewed as being anti-institutional. And those are things that kind of ring true to us.
So punk rock. You know,
yeah, right. but he wanted people to be involved in the prophetic ministry, and it wasn't something simply reserved for the clergy, but was something that was available for all people. And so we know that it spreads into that part of Europe, and it spreads into North Africa as well after that, because Tertullian, who writes in the third century, in the early third century, he famously becomes a supporter of Montanism. But what form of Montanism he supports is the question. It certainly isn't, and the same with Irenaeus, it certainly isn't the form of Montanism where, you know, Montanus is the new voice of the Lord. What we can at least, I think, confidently say in regards to Irenaeus as well as Tertullian is that they supported a broad understanding of who participates in ministry. They supported the moral rigor as well. They saw the importance of the martyrs and the faith that they demonstrated, and that was highly important to early Montanism as well.
This is fascinating to me, hearing you talk about the ways that Montanism, you know, took root. The aspects that are indicative of Montanism, because it sounds to me, especially the things that you're talking about that are valuable about Montanism, I was like, oh, so priesthood of, you know, royal priesthood, priesthood of believers. That sounds pretty biblical, right? That sounds not so much rooted in Montanism, but I mean, you're gonna have the kingdom of priests all the way back in Exodus 19, verse 6 and 7, so or 5 and 6. So clearly, it's not a new idea. It's quite rooted in scripture. Having a moral rigor. I don't think anybody has ever thought the Bible has to say nothing to the way in which we live, but actually is calling us to a life of both sacrifice, focus, Christ-likeness, making our wills bend to his. Again, I wouldn't call that Montanism. I'd call that Christianity. It seems like there are like hallmarks of Montanism that are highlighting things that are pointing back to scripture, but the things that are specific to Montanism are heresy, right? Dr. John Delhousse, when I was back at Phoenix Seminary, his definition of heresy is Jesus and. If you're going to add, if you are pointing people to a thing that will set them free, and you're like, yes, you must have Jesus and also this other thing, that's heresy. And the longer you talk about some of the things that Montanus came and said, I am the voice, listen to me, follow what I'm saying, that all is heretical. And that all sounds very, very close to some of the things that we have with Jehovah's Witnesses and Mormonism. And all of these things, I mean, I made the Harold Camping joke, but that's not a joke. I mean, people's lives were ruined by that man. And so Jesus and is a problem. So people pointing people, someone like Montanus, pointing people back to scripture and saying we need to faithfully follow, that is a good thing. Pointing people to himself being the new mouthpiece of the Lord, that is a very bad thing. And it's incredible that this came from that same region of this faithful church. It's unfortunate that even you're making the connection of Jesus says a good thing about the New Jerusalem, and then some chucklehead comes and takes Jesus' words and twists them mightily and says, now listen to me, Jesus and.
Yeah. And that's the thing about Montanus himself that's unclear. We don't know exactly what he believes about Jesus, although we do know that he believes that he and what he now speaks is the new revelation. It's the new authority that should be followed.
Yes, and that clearly,
it's clearly problematic. So we have to wrestle with that. And of course, you know, later in church history, Montanism is declared a heresy because those practices end up evolving into modalism, where, you know, now God has appeared as the Father in the Old Testament, now he's the Son in the New Testament, and now he's the Spirit in the church age. And it seems as if Montanism takes on those kind of modalistic tendencies where now the Spirit prophesying through the person becomes the new authority and so on. But he's an interesting person. And I think, you know, part of the takeaways from looking at Montanism and in the area of Phrygia and particularly the city of Philadelphia that we have to take away is really a cautionary tale that we need to be very careful about who we appoint as leaders in the church. Because by all accounts, Montanus, as passionate as he was a new believer. I think it's Eusebius that describes him as having an ambition to be a leader in the church, and that ambition is really what's driving him to do the things that he's doing, more than, you know, the transformed life. And so I think Montanus kind of gives us that cautionary story of what could happen if we appoint leaders into churches while they're still immature in the faith or young in the faith. And this is something that Paul warns about as well.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's pretty replete in all of the descriptions of elders, right? Not new to the faith. One of the clear things for us. Well, Michael, this has been exciting walking down this road. And I know that as we continue on, as we have episodes that are going to be pointing to your new book, there are going to be other churches and other discoveries and things that we will be looking at. And then also, we're not here just to talk about cool history stuff, but it is that, okay, and so now what does that mean for us? And we want to bring that to the table. We want to come to Christ. We want to submit and be changed by him and then move forward in his wisdom as we are pursuing him in this world. If there were things that you were excited about, you, our listener, who we love so much, we're glad that you joined us. And I do keep using this phrase in this series. If you are new to this podcast and this series, we do have others on our Archaeology Meets Missiology Archaeology Meets Missiology series. And there are things that we are discovering. There are things that we are learning. And oftentimes we are going to point you to masterclasses.ephesiology.com to go and pursue either degrees or information that is going to continue to help you. But we have our very own Dr. Michael Cooper. He will probably not refer to himself as Michigan Cooper, but maybe you can, and you can call him that. And just make him awkwardly laugh every time. He is going to be hosting a seminar. That's what professional people call it. There is going to be a seminar on the 21st of May. Funny date you picked, because that is actually when Harold Camping said, I think last, that Jesus was going to appear, was the 21st of May. On the 21st of May, 2026, there will be an online seminar. It will be at 4:00 Pacific Daylight Time. So Pacific PDT, 4 p.m. or 7 p.m. on the Eastern time zone in America, here on the North American side. The seminar is called If the Stones Could Speak, How Archaeology Reveals the Church's Mission. Since I have the presenter here, Michael, in a sentence or two, what are you hoping to accomplish at this seminar?
Literally to show us where the stones are speaking. And I mean, I can get super geeky about this.
I know. That's why I asked you only for a sentence or two. Right? I'm trying to hold you back, man.
Yeah, I don't want to give it all away. But we're going to look at some fascinating inscriptions that tell us something about, well, tell us a lot about what the church believed about Jesus. And so I'm excited to be able to talk about these things. And they tell us something about why this is important in the ministry of the church today.
Seminars are great, like podcasts. You get a lot of really good information. You get to listen to somebody. You get to take it in. Key to this seminar is there is going to be a live Q&A at the back end. And so if there are some of these things that you have been hearing in our Archaeology Meets Missiology series, which he is going to be speaking more clearly during this seminar, please sign up. Please register for this, and then you can show up and actually have that Q&A. You can ask those questions. You can listen to Michigan Cooper bring all of these wonderful words. Michael, where can people register for this?
We'll put it in the show notes. There'll be a link for the Zoom registration there.
Okay. Well, Michael, I'm excited about that. I am excited for you, our listener or listeners. We do have more than one to go and to register. You'll find that in the show notes. And we are excited for what God is going to continue to show us as we do theology and community on the Ephesiology podcast. And so to you, our listener, thank you. And we will see you soon.